As John said, this program could not be better timed given the release on Monday of the Republican plan to replace the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Our speaker today, Carolyn Long Engelhardt, spoke here to the Senior Statesman of Virginia in September of 2010, explaining the ACA before it became called Obamacare. Her background is she has a degree in sociology from St. Thomas in Houston, Texas, and an MPA, public administration, from the University of Virginia. But she's a professor who directs the health policy program at the Department of Public Health Science at the University School of Medicine. Her academic activities include analyzing and monitoring changes in the health policy at the federal and state level, as well as teaching at the Graduate School of Arts and Science at the University and the School of Medicine. She's co-authored a book looking at the myths surrounding the U.S. healthcare system and completed a project in conjunction with a nonpartisan urban institute examining the use of public policies to reduce obesity, and contributed to a textbook on the new law in health organizations. She is also a contributing health policy expert for web-based news journal and thehill.com. A week ago, the president said, "Now I have to tell you, it's an unbelievably complex subject. Nobody knew healthcare could be so complicated. I'm here to tell you that if anyone can clarify the complexity, it's our speaker. Please join me in welcoming Professor Engelhardt."
Well, hi, everybody. It's great to be here. It's so nice to see my Ollie students and my friends and colleagues. Gosh, has it been since 2010? It's a good thing none of us look any older, isn't it? Absolutely. Okay, so I've been given the job of helping you understand where we are with healthcare reform today. I use that term loosely because I have found in the past when I use the word reform, people think that means I'm in favor of something. I don't mean that. Let's just call it healthcare policy then. So let's get started. I have only 12 slides. They're kind of packed. I've never been accused of being someone who doesn't talk very much. But I know that you are here today because you want to talk about what's going on and you probably have lots of questions. So I hope we can get through this in a timely manner so that you can also participate in this discussion. All righty, so let's get going. So before we discuss why we need to, or why the Republicans in the House of Representatives voted to repeal Obamacare 60 times unsuccessfully, why people were dissatisfied with the Affordable Care Act, which, by the way, you know, is Obamacare, then I thought we would just go back a little bit and look at what our country's healthcare status was like, healthcare coverage was like, right before the Affordable Care Act came to be. Maybe it can give us some perspective about where we are now. So you can see here from 1999 to 2010, this is where Americans got health insurance. So employer-sponsored insurance still is the largest provider of health insurance coverage. 156 million Americans get health insurance where they work and their dependents. But you can see over the last, that decade, it went down. And government insurance went up some. That's because the baby boomers started aging up. We have more people in Medicare. Also because we had just come through a very deep recession. People had lost their jobs. More people became eligible for Medicaid. And the uninsured also went up, as you can see, 16.3%. And this is for all Americans, including those over 65. If we looked at the percent of Americans without insurance under the age of 65, it would be closer to 19%. And so, oh, you won't be able to read that, but that's okay. This just basically, the bottom slide just basically shows you who are those folks without insurance. So I sat on the board of our local free clinic for 12 years, and I now am fortunate enough to sit on the state board of free clinics in Virginia, and we oversee 60 free clinics. And I learned, firsthand, the people who don't have health insurance are people who often work 2 and 3 jobs, usually minimum wage. Sometimes they're paid under the table in cash. But you can see here, 37% were under 250% of the federal poverty level, which is maybe $26,000 a year, and so on. So the uninsured, by and large, work. Many are what we call the working poor, and they depend on safety net hospitals and free clinics to get health care. But nothing is free. Who pays for all the uninsured's care? We do. We all do. It's been estimated that in our health insurance premiums, between $300 and $600 goes towards defraying the costs of the uninsured. So it just makes sense to try to deal with this in a more rational way. And that's what the Affordable Care Act tried to do. And the Affordable Care Act tried to do it in a couple of ways. I'm going to just briefly outline what Obamacare wanted to do so we know what we're giving up or what we want to replace. So first of all, they said, well, let me go back, because you see that bottom green circle where it says other private and uninsured. So the other private means the individual insurance market, where the N is always one, and you go to the open market and you buy health insurance. And before the Affordable Care Act, if someone tried to buy health insurance on the individual market and they had a history of hypertension, so the individual insurance market is a very, before the Affordable Care Act, was a fairly cruel market, in that if you had a family history of cancer or hypertension or heart disease or diabetes, you either were charged up to 7 or 8 times more than somebody else if you could get insurance, or oftentimes you just couldn't find insurance. You weren't able to get insurance. So the Affordable Care Act really came to be to address those two populations, people without health insurance who are uninsured, and the folks who were on the individual market but either were disproportionately sick and were charged much more or couldn't get health insurance at all. Okay, so what did the ACA do? Well, you all know this, so I'll go through this briefly. Set up these marketplaces, these virtual marketplaces, which they called exchanges, sort of like Expedia or Travelocity, something you would go to on your computer. You'd go in, you'd put in your zip code. They would check with the IRS, look at what your income was last year, ask you questions about your income, whether you were a smoker, if you had dependents, and so on. And then they would assign you a subsidy if your income was less than 400% of the federal poverty level. And then, depending on your zip code, they would then show you what plans were available. You could go in, you could pick a plan, and then the subsidy would be mailed to the insurance company, and you would pay the balance for the premium. Now, what the ACA did was it regulated insurance. It required all insurers to offer certain benefits that were very comprehensive, and that was part of the controversy around the ACA. So it included inpatient, outpatient, prescription drugs, mental health, maternity, rehab, and so on. They regulated insurance companies so that they all had to offer those benefits, and they couldn't turn you away if you had a pre-existing condition. Secondly, in order to expand coverage, the ACA expanded the traditional Medicaid program. Now, I do a whole lecture at UVA on what Medicaid is, and I could spend forever talking to you about what Medicaid is and what it isn't, but let's just have the abridged version. And basically, traditional Medicaid is what we call a categorical program. It only covers categories of people like poor kids and poor pregnant women and poor frail elderly and the disabled. What many Americans don't realize is that in many states, Virginia still, if you are a childless adult and you are not considered to be disabled, you could live under a bridge, in a box, over a grate. You could be completely indigent and you would not be eligible for Medicaid. So the architects of the Affordable Care Act knew that those chronically uninsured people, many of them were poor working people who were childless and weren't disabled, weren't pregnant, and weren't kids, and weren't frail elderly. So they said, let's raise the threshold to 138% of the federal poverty level, which is about $16,000, and cover them. Well, that was challenged in the Supreme Court as being unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court basically said, it's up to each state. And 31 states have expanded their Medicaid programs and 19 have not, and Virginia is one that has not. The next part of the ACA to expand coverage was to compel employers with more than 50 employees to offer health insurance or pay a penalty. Now, 99% of large employers offer health insurance. Remember, before the ACA, offering health insurance at your workplace was voluntary. And yet, who among us in this room did not get health coverage when we were working where we worked? So it's a valued employee benefit. And what the ACA tried to do is say everyone has to do their fair share, and so employers step up. And then young adults up to the age of 26 could stay on their parents' plan. There are generally 3 million young adults at any one time exercising this benefit, and there have been about 7 million since the law was passed. And all of this was supposed to be tied together through this individual mandate that asks that everyone purchase health insurance or pay a penalty. So that is the structure of the Affordable Care Act. What you want? That's later. Okay, so the ACA survived four near-death experiences before in its lifetime, and most of my talk after this will be about the fifth one that we're in right now. So the first one had to do with Senator Teddy Kennedy dying in August of 2009, which robbed the Senate of the 60 votes that was required to pass a law in the Senate. There were 58 Democrats and two independents that caucused with the Democrats. And when Senator Kennedy died in August of 2009, they lost that 60th vote. The governor of Massachusetts appointed someone to stand in until a special election. That person, of course, was a Democrat because they were from Massachusetts. And it did pass through the Senate. But when the special election in January of 2010 came along, when I say it passed through the Senate, it got through the Senate, and then the House had passed their version of the ACA, and they met in conference committee in January, and then later that month in 2010, Scott Brown won Senator Kennedy's seat in a special election representing the first Republican in 35 years, which robbed the Senate again of the 60th Democrat. So anyway, through sleight of hand and lots of shenanigans, the ACA did get passed, but it was really tortured. That was the first near-death experience. The second one was, as I mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court challenge, which challenged the constitutionality of the individual mandate and the Medicaid expansion. And by 5-4, the Supreme Court upheld the ACA. The third had to do with President Obama's reelection. At that time, the midterm elections had happened in 2010, and the House had gone Republican. The Senate was still Democratic. And many governors, Republican governors, hoped that Mitt Romney would win, that the Senate would go Republican, and they could just get rid of the whole damn bill. But it didn't happen. As we know, President Obama was reelected. That was the third. The fourth was another challenge at the Supreme Court, where they challenged the language They challenged the constitutionality of these federal marketplaces or exchanges based on a semantic, literal interpretation of five words in the bill. And again, the Supreme Court came down on the side of the ACA, this time a 6-3 ruling. But what's important to remember is that this was the most significant health policy legislation since the passage of Medicare and Medicaid in the mid-1960s, and there is no precedent in our country's history to reverse a major social program once it's gone into effect. So we are in a pretty historic time right now. Okay, so where are we with regard to the Affordable Care Act? I mentioned the exchanges. I just want to give you the numbers. So right now, there are about 12 million Americans who get health insurance on these exchanges. As I mentioned, most of them get it through the federal exchange. Some states have exchanges of their own. The enrollment is less than they anticipated. We could argue why that is. But it's about 12.2 million. In Virginia, it's about 400,000 people who signed up on the federal exchange for an Obamacare plan, an ACA plan. The Medicaid expansion has been very popular. As I mentioned, 31 states plus the District of Columbia, there are about 12 million people now getting health insurance through the Medicaid expansion who were uninsured before. One in five Americans now are covered through Medicaid. It may interest you to know that almost 50% of all childbirths in this country are paid for by Medicaid. There's been about a 50% reduction in the uninsured rate. It's now down to about 9%. Remember, I talked before about an 18% of people under the age of 65. It's now down to 9%. We can talk about what kind of coverage people have, and I will. Those are the numbers. And 20 million Americans now have health insurance who did not have it before. Okay, so this is a really interesting chart. So I want you to look at this chart, and this is a chart from Real Clear Politics that does a compendium of public opinion surveys. So they take tons, 50 surveys, and they put them all together, and these represent averages. And it asks a question, do you approve of the health care law? Do you approve of the Affordable Care Act? Now, the red line on the top is no. The black line on the bottom is yes. So, as you can see, since the law was passed in 2010, more Americans have disapproved of the Affordable Care Act than have approved. That little vertical dotted line there is when the election came. So what does this tell us? It tells us that public opinion about Obamacare was not very positive. Now, during these years, these intervening years, when you would ask people, well, do you like the fact that your child can stay on your health care plan? Oh, I really like that part. Do you like the part that you can't be turned away for insurance because of pre-existing conditions? Yeah, I really like that part. You like the part where you can't have any lifetime caps on medical care if you have a chronic condition? I like that part. And then you say, well, how do you feel about the individual mandate where you have to buy insurance? I hate that part. The government should never tell Americans what they have to do. So the Republicans were much better at relaying a message that Obamacare was bad. And I'm not saying Obamacare was perfect, but they did a better job of messaging that. And public opinion, as we know, perception in many cases is reality. And besides, most of us would rather complain than not. So the truth is that the ACA created winners and losers. So who were the winners? The winners were low-income Americans who were uninsured and got a large subsidy to buy health insurance. The losers were people, particularly younger people, who made just a little more money than the subsidies allowed and had to buy insurance on their own. So before the ACA, so imagine you're 33 years old, you're an independent contractor, you make $60,000 a year, you can work out of your home because you've got a cell phone and a laptop, And before the ACA, you were able to buy a bare bones, high deductible health plan for $100 a month. After the ACA, because of the regulations that required that all insurance products be comprehensive, you now don't, you're not eligible for a subsidy because you make more than $45,000, which is 400% of the federal poverty level, and because you have to buy maternity coverage, mental health coverage, all of those benefits, your insurance now costs $400 a month. So that's $5,000 in after-tax money. Those of us who get health insurance where we work actually are able to buy our health insurance in pre-tax dollars, which lowers our taxable income. So folks on the other side bought it with after-tax dollars, and if they were healthy and young, they didn't like it at all. They were the losers. The individual mandate was horribly disliked, as I mentioned, but you have to have it. You cannot make insurance companies take all comers, no matter how sick they are, unless you have healthy people in the risk pool. The math of insurance just doesn't work that way. You will never get stable premiums unless you have a mixture of healthy to compensate for the utilization of the sick. The benefits were appreciated, particularly if you had a chronic illness, but it made healthcare more expensive. The guaranteed issue, that is, that no one could be turned away, did provide an incentive for people not to buy health insurance until they became sick, and the penalties under the ACA were not large, and many believe that's part of the reason there was so much adverse selection in the insurance pool, because healthy people decided they'd rather pay the penalty than pay that $5,000 a year, like in the example of our young independent contractor. And there were limits on age ratings. So my students, before the ACA, if they bought health insurance and I tried to buy that same plan, I could be charged up to 7 times more. Under the ACA, they reduced that band to 3 times more. And so what that meant was it was a modified community rating. It meant that younger people paid more so that older people could pay less. So you can see there are winners and losers. And basically, I don't want you to have to read all this, but basically what it says is that lots of people didn't like it. Many people found it unaffordable, and that fewer people enrolled than they anticipated, which meant there was a sicker risk pool and premiums steadily climbed up, which ultimately made some insurance companies exit the market, which only made things worse. Going into 2017, the average increase for premiums was 25%, and 30% of the counties in the United States had only one insurance carrier. This is not good if you're trying to structure a healthcare system based on choice and competition. Okay, so here we go. That's the situation going into the presidential election. So Donald Trump won it by a very small amount. As many of you know, he lost the popular vote. Hillary Clinton won 3 million more the popular vote, but because presidents are elected with electoral college votes, Donald Trump carried a few states with a very slim margin and won. Republicans have lost the popular vote in 6 of the last 7 presidential races. 4 different polls since the election have, and some of them are, I mean, they're not all liberal groups. We have Fox News and so on. Several surveys have come out since the election asking people how they feel about the ACA since President Trump and many people who ran for Congress ran on overturning, on repealing Obamacare. And in these 4 polls conducted in January, they reported for the first time in over 6 years, more voters favored keeping the ACA than wanting to repeal it. And so it's sort of ironic that actually the Republicans may have been able to accomplish what the Democrats never could, which is to make Obamacare popular. So public opinion appears to be shifting away from just saying repeal, we don't like it, to imagining that 20 million people might lose their health coverage. This is just a Pew survey. I know you can't see it very well, but it basically says, asked Americans whether the federal government should make sure all Americans have health coverage. And this was conducted in January. 60% said yes, 38% said no. Okay, all those red states are states that have Republican governors and Republican legislatures. This phenomenon has not happened in almost a century, that 25 states have a Republican governor and a legislature. What does this mean? This should make Congress, who's also Republican in the legislative and the executive branches, feel pretty good about their agenda. We've got a lot. Obviously, we're in a very historically conservative time. However, of the 12 million people who enrolled for the ACA, 8 million came from Trump states. And if the ACA is repealed, it's projected that 6 out of 9 Trump voters could conceivably lose their health insurance. In fact, Speaker Ryan's district fell, an insurance rate fell by 45% because of the ACA. That suggests that there might be a political backlash if people lose their health insurance. Okay, so I mentioned that the Republicans in the House had voted over 60 times to repeal the ACA. In December of 2015, the Senate was Republican, the House was Republican. They put together what's called a reconciliation bill. It's a budget technique that you can attach to a budget bill. It's a rider. And you can change current legislation, but only those pieces that have a fiscal impact. It's called a Reconciliation Act. So in 2015, they attached a reconciliation bill to this budget resolution that basically repealed all the fiscal pieces of the ACA, repealed the taxes. The ACA cost $1 trillion over 10 years, $100 billion a year. And the way they paid for it was through taxes on insurance companies, on the pharmaceutical companies, on the medical device companies. They asked hospitals to take less of an increase on their Medicare reimbursements. They taxed higher income citizens more on their Medicare payroll tax, and so on. They had to come up with this money, and that's how they did it. So this Reconciliation Act repealed all of those taxes. It repealed the subsidies that allow people to go to the exchange and buy health insurance, and the Medicaid expansion. It eliminated the individual and employer mandates. It repealed the public health fund. Probably you all don't know about that. That's a $20 billion fund that, by the way, was going to fund the 21st Century Cures Act. That was all that finally made it through Congress. It had to do with the cancer moonshot and more mental health services. So if that goes, that goes. And the CBO came out and said, if this repeal goes forward without a replacement, 20 to 30 million Americans will lose coverage. This made it through the House. It made it through the Senate because, unlike other bills, budget bills in the Senate only require a simple majority, only 51 votes. So it made it through the House, made it through the Senate, and it was vetoed by President Obama in December 2015. So fast forward, we now have a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican president. So on January, when the 115th Congress came in, their first act was to say, let's resurrect this reconciliation bill and get it through. We should be able to get it signed right away. Well, you know that didn't happen because, as our president said and Rich said, it's really complicated. So the reconciliation bill can get rid of lots of things, but there's some things it can't get rid of because it doesn't have a fiscal impact. It can't get rid of the ban on pre-existing conditions. Can't get rid of the guaranteed issue. It can't get rid of the lifetime limits. So you would, by taking away all the pieces that actually pay for it, so without subsidies, insurance companies would have to take people, but there'd be no way to pay them. So it was complicated, and most experts believed that if reconciliation went forward and all these people lost health insurance, that it would just be cost shifting, and that once again we would go back to where we were before the ACA, where safety net hospitals would absorb a lot of indigent care, and states and families and others would pick up the slack. So the Republicans came up with these replacement ideas. And these were just theoretical ideas that had been part of the Republican orthodoxy for decades. And they're things like more health savings accounts, high-risk pools, buying insurance across state lines, making health insurance leaner. So you don't have to have all of those things like maternity and mental health coverage if you're a young, healthy 30-year-old. And you don't need them, those sorts of things. And so they were talking about these. So some of these ideas they can do through reconciliation. Many of them they cannot because it requires 60 votes in the Senate because it has to do with more than just a fiscal impact. So that's where we were until last Monday. So the American Health Care Act that was released on Monday contains many of those aspects that came from the reconciliation bill, but also brought in some of the things from the replacement ideas. So what does it say it will do? Well, it says it will eliminate all the ACA taxes. Something like the taxes, I have this written down somewhere because I can't possibly keep all of this in my brain. ACA taxes will bring in $600 billion over 10 years. Eliminate all the taxes, substantially cut funding to states that expanding their Medicaid programs, reduce financial assistance for the low income, and actually offer a different kind of subsidy to the young person who, the example I gave, would now be eligible for a subsidy. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. It became part of an overall strategy, really, to try to move our healthcare system into more of a market-based system where people relied less on government subsidies and more on individual responsibility by allowing more pre-tax contributions to health savings accounts, allowing insurance companies to sell different kinds of products that would be more or less expensive depending on what you needed, and so on. They knew that they had to stabilize this individual market because the insurers had already signaled that with much more adverse selection in 2017, they didn't know if they would be able to, we'd have enough insurers on the ACA exchanges. And they have to declare in June this year whether or not they will participate. If they do not, and millions of people are dropped, then woe be to the politician running in the 2018 midterm election. So it's a big political gamble for the Republican leaders, and what I call the GOP conundrum is this. This is not rocket science. You all know this. So think about it. To have a healthy insurance pool, you have to have people who use it and people who don't. And you really want people who don't. Insurance is the only product where they don't want you to use what they sell. I mean, if I make shoes, they want you to buy shoes. If I make Hostess cupcakes, they want you to buy my cupcakes. Insurers want to sell you insurance, and they love it if you don't use it. And then because the premiums remain stable for everybody in the pool. So rule number one is you got to get a lot of people in the pool that don't use it. So that means healthy people. So, in order to get healthy people to buy insurance, you have to make sure health insurance is affordable. The ACA tried to do that through the subsidies, but you can't, and the individual mandate tried to compel that through penalties, but you got to get people to buy insurance to come into the pool. And since insurance now is very expensive, most of us don't know this, but if you go out to the market without your employer contribution, an individual insurance plan is about $5,000 and a family plan is about $18,000. So when you think of that as a percent of your family income, you need help. Most Americans do. The median household income in this country is a little over $50,000 a year. So you have to get healthy people to join the pool. You have to give people subsidies to help them buy it if they're not rich. And if you don't want to raise the deficit, you're going to have to figure out how to pay for it. And generally, that's through the T word that nobody wants to talk about. So the take-home message is that history suggests it's much harder to take away an entitlement than it is to introduce it. Okay, I'm almost done. So where are we now? President Trump and the 115th Congress now own Obamacare, whatever we call it. It's theirs. It's under their watch. They can go on the news. They can say, we inherited this mess. It was terrible. Americans are going to judge them on what happens now. Any successful Republican bill will have to address concerns of their party. And right now, there is disagreement about what a bill should look like. There are conservative factions, like Senator Paul Rand from Kentucky, and others who think that that government shouldn't be involved at all in helping buy purchase health insurance. And then on the other end of the continuum, you have senators from Medicaid expansion states that are terrified that their constituents will lose their insurance when Medicaid expansion changes or goes away. 31 governors, including 16 Republican governors plus 20 Republican senators and 120 Republican House members are from these states that have expanded their Medicaid program. And if Medicaid expansion ends, these states will give up $40 billion a year in federal money. But what I really think is important is to ask, what is the goal? I mean, really, what is the goal? What is the goal of healthcare policy? What's the goal of Obamacare? Or what's the goal of the American Healthcare Act? Whatever we want to call it. The goal is very different for politicians who want a smaller government, want to reduce the deficit, have an ideological dog in the fight that believes strongly government should be less prominent in our lives. That's what politicians want, policymakers. People on the ground, the people at the free clinic, the patients in the hospital, your children, your grandchildren, what they want is affordable health care. They want doctors they can go to. They want to be able to afford their medications. They don't want to make it so complicated. In focus groups in Rust Belt states shortly after the election, they asked Trump voters all these questions. And what they said was they were anxious about rising health insurance premiums and their deductibles, and particularly their prescription drug costs. They said insurance was hopelessly complex, and they feared they would be unable to afford coverage for themselves and their families. This new legislation that's being floated moves away from income-based subsidies to age-based refundable tax credits. That's a subtle distinction, perhaps, but it's a big one, because it means that the 25-year-old who makes $60,000 will get a $2,000 tax credit, and the 25-year-old who makes $20,000 will get a $2,000 tax credit. And so by not making it indexed to your income, you will have lower income people where the refundable tax credit probably won't be enough to help them buy insurance. And you will have wealthier folks, if you want to call them that. I don't think people, it caps at 75K. I don't know how many of us think 75,000 is wealthy, but it's above the median household income. They would also get the refundable tax credit. People who are older would be disadvantaged. The tax refundable tax credits go up as you age, and for a 60-year-old, it would be a $4,000 tax credit. But under this plan, states can also expand the rating band so that people my age can be charged now five times more. So if I have a voucher for $4,000, if I have a tax credit for $4,000 and I'm going out to the market and my health insurance now costs $18,000, that may or may not be enough for me to be able to buy health insurance. So I have to tell you, I may have used this slide when I was with you. I dragged this slide out from a 2009 talk I gave on, this was during the healthcare reform debate, but it could not be more appropriate today. And that is, we have competing philosophies as to the fundamental nature and purpose of health insurance. So the traditional Democratic philosophy believes that health insurance should really be a medical payment system, not only covering catastrophic events that are unforeseen, as our homeowners insurance is, or maybe our automobile insurance, but that it's really about preventing people from going into bankruptcy because of medical bills, and to encourage preventive care to keep us healthy. On the other hand, the traditional Republican philosophy believes much more strongly that health insurance should really be a market product, that it should be more like traditional insurance, and that it should be more like, I mean, we don't have, you know, car insurance that pays for oil changes, that we should pay out of pocket for small everyday medical things and save insurance for the big ticket items, like when we have cancer or break our leg or have a hip replacement or whatever. And that certainly we shouldn't get taxes, we shouldn't rely on our fellow taxpayers to help cross-subsidize that for us. Relying on taxpayer subsidized health care for others is anathema to Republicans. I'm sorry, someone asked me if I had any big words. Just anathema. So this is really what I hope we can talk about a little bit or think about. And that is, have we changed as a country in 7 years? Have we changed about how we think about health insurance and what it is and what the role of government is? If Obamacare has sort of become the new normal, and as the Pew survey suggests, that Americans now are more comfortable with having government step in and help people buy affordable health insurance, then where do we go forward? How do we change? How do we repair where we, how do we have another health care? How do we do this? And so the political battle right now is who will help Americans pay to keep insured and how will it be paid? Just so we all are clear on this, this is a bill that is in committee. It's in two committees in the House. It has not been scored by the Congressional Budget Office. There's been an outside body. The Congressional Budget Office looks at legislation and says, if it will affect the deficit over 10 years, if it increases the deficit, it gets an automatic go back to the drawing board. We're not going to do this. And it talks about its impacts with regard, in this case, to how many people will lose health insurance or keep health insurance. There's been an outside body that has looked at the at this bill, and they have estimated, and this is a Standard and Poor's, so I don't think you'd call it a liberal rag, and they estimate that 6 to 10 million people will lose their health insurance if this draft ever becomes legislation. So, I don't know if you can read the cartoon, but the physician says, really, I think you're worrying too much about the change from Obamacare to Trump care. Thank you for your attention. You've been a great audience.
If you're willing to take a few questions, we have a microphone on each side. So there's a question already.
I think we have till three, don't we? So we have a long time. Yeah, I know you guys have questions.
You didn't talk about association health plans. They were talked about a lot in the run-up to the unfolding on Monday, but I haven't heard anything since. Are they in this draft or not?
I don't believe so. But I don't know for sure. I haven't read the, it's only 200 pages. I haven't read it. But I will tell you that in the bill, you may not, you are not eligible for tax credits if you have lottery winnings. I'm sorry, sir. I don't know. I don't believe it's in this bill. I have read everything. It's not in there.
My question is, I didn't hear you mention at all, I think, while you were speaking, what I consider to be maybe the elephant in the room, which is revealed by the $18,000 premium of the family. It's the cost of health care. If no one can afford it, then aren't we going at this in the wrong way? Now, there's a few things that were in the ACA that were addressing that, but not nearly enough, and I don't see very much of it at all in this bill.
I'm so glad you brought that up. That is the elephant in the room, and this bill here doesn't address that at all. And the ACA didn't very much, except by changing the way we paid physicians. That has the potential to save a lot of money, but it's very slow going. Yes, so maybe I can come back and give you my lecture on what drives healthcare spending. But the short answer is we consume way too much. We consume stuff that we don't need. We are incapable of saying no. And we do lots of things that really don't work. But we, unlike other countries, and we can argue whether, you know, whether what Canada does or Germany does is better than what we do, but we don't allow Medicare to negotiate prices for drugs with pharmaceutical companies. And you say that, and most Americans say they're for it, and Trump said he was for it on the campaign trail, and so did Hillary Clinton, but just imagine, so yes, you're for it, but then all of a sudden there's this thing called the identifiable victim bias. All of a sudden you bring up little Johnny who's dying from a rare disease, and without, you know, the pharmaceutical industry pouring tons of money to try to help little Johnny may die, and then all of a sudden trying to, you know, squeeze R&D, which the pharmaceutical industry says we'll do if we don't pay these prices, becomes very complicated. So, that is our challenge. Last year, we spent 5.8%, excuse me, last year, healthcare spending grew 5.8%. Does anybody know how much our economy grew last year? This has been the scenario for over 35 years. It's not going to get better. There are 10,000 people a day, like me and some of you, who are aging up to age 65, and that goes on for 18 years, 10,000 people a day for 18 years, becoming 65 and becoming eligible for Medicare. We were the children of the 60s. We will not go quietly into the night in our orthopedic shoes. We will expect everything medicine can offer us, and medicine can offer us a lot. So that is the conversation we need to have. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, if you want me to, if I were Tsarina, there would be things I would do, but we can talk about that later.
Thank you so much for a great address. You live up to all your ratings, by the way. You mentioned that this is just 200 pages. Now, as I understand it, the original act was
2000.
How can you change 2,000 pages in 200 pages and really think you've done anything?
Good point. I'll tell you why. How? First of all, remember, it's a reconciliation. It's got to be attached to a budget bill, so it can only touch those things that have a fiscal impact. So by design, it has to be narrow. Also, the Republicans hope to work in conjunction with President Trump. As you know, he's been doing a lot through executive orders, and he can do things. Secretary Tom Price of Health and Human Services is an orthopedic surgeon. He's part of the Freedom Caucus in the House, which is the most conservative faction in the House of Representatives. In the 2,000-page bill, there were hundreds of incidences that said the secretary will decide. So the Secretary of Health and Human Services can go in and he can have a lot. For a good example of that is no cost sharing for contraceptives. Under the Affordable Care Act, all contraceptives have no copay. I have to tell you a funny little story. I promise it'll only be like 2 minutes, if that. So I was giving a talk. I mean, you think my job is easy. Let me tell you. I was giving a talk to a Chinese delegation about the Affordable Care Act. They spoke no English. So there was a translator. And, I mean, the cultural differences were unbelievable. But part of my talk had to do with the increase in preventive care. And actually, a real success story in public health has been the decrease of teen pregnancy. And part of that, because we know that when teens give birth, their babies tend to have lower birth weight, the moms drop out of high school. It's bad. So I was telling the Chinese this had been a really big success, and we think part of the reason is because contraceptives were so much more available, because now they could get them without cost sharing, and teens now were using more long-acting contraceptives like IUDs, sorry. And so all of a sudden the Chinese got this look on their face, and they looked at me and they said, "So the state is forcing IUDs on teens." I'm like, no, don't go back and say that. So the Secretary of Health and Human Services can change that, and I'm sure he will. I'm sure he will change that so that there will no longer be no cost sharing. Forgive the double negatives. And that's just one. There are many scores of things like that. So the idea is that this does this, executive orders do this, the secretary does this, and it will congeal into some sort of unified policy that will reflect Republican principles.
Thank you. I guess the question I have is what finally comes out of this? You have certain concepts of it's very difficult to change benefits when they've been given to the population. There are certain things that Republicans want to get done, but what is your best case scenario in terms of looking out now 3 years and where we'll be in 3 years? What will be kept? What will be discarded? What will it cost?
I wish I were Larry Sabato. I don't bill myself as a futurist. I bill myself as a translator. John Boehner, the former Speaker of the House, said Republicans will never get this through. They can't agree on anything. The Affordable Care Act is the only major piece of social policy that never garnered one vote from the opposing party. If the Democrats dig their heels in and say, we're going to be the party of no, then if something gets passed, it'll get passed through this reconciliation and signed by the president. And then there may be a political backlash in 2018, and the Senate may go back to Democratic, maybe the House. If 10 million people lose insurance, I mean, what we learned from the presidential election is that we used to think poor people didn't vote. I think in this last presidential election, poor people voted. So, you know, I think that it will... If I could make a wish, my wish would be that they would try to fix the ACA. I mean, there are lots of things that have happened. The ACA has been crippled over 6 years. Part of the reason the insurance companies exited, Aetna and United exited, is because originally under the Affordable Care Act, the federal government promised insurers if they took sicker people, they would make them whole in the end through a reinsurance mechanism. And then the Republican majority House refused to appropriate funds to do that. So insurance companies took sicker people and lost their shirts. And there was a couple of reasons for that. One, they lost their shirts because anybody in here an insurance person? So oftentimes what happens when you sell insurance in different markets, in different kinds of insurance, is you go into a market and you underprice your product to get market volume. And if you have a diversified enough portfolio, you can carry that loss for a while, and then, you know, you have that market leverage. So I think insurers came in the first year not knowing who would sign up for the exchanges, thinking they would look like the employer-based group, but instead they looked like the Medicaid group. They were sicker. We know that the uninsured use 50% of the health care that insured people use, and when they do enter the system, they enter sicker and they die earlier. So we knew there'd be this pent-up demand, but the CBO thought that a lot more people would join and stabilize the risk pool. That didn't happen. There were 11 million people on the exchange in 2016. The CBO had predicted in 2014 there would be 21 million. So part of what needs to, if we're going to believe that government is necessary to help people buy insurance, that everybody should have insurance, then you're going to have to keep insurers around. And in order to do that, you're going to have to provide them some protection about so that if they take on high risks, they will be compensated for that risk. And, you know, there are sort of ways to, there are ways to do that. You can do that through competition. You can do that through regulation. This new thing, pretty much, I was lying in bed last night. See, my life is so boring. I was lying in bed thinking about being with you today and thinking about, you know, the Paul Ryan bill, this bill that's just come out, in many ways is a present to the insurance industry. They're allowing the states to have a lot more flexibility so that they can have leaner plans. They can regulate. For instance, right now, the Obamacare subsidies cannot be used towards a high deductible health plan. Under this new thing, the American health plan, these tax credits can and are encouraged to be used for high deductible health plans. By getting poor, sick people off the insurance rolls, the insurance industry will be healthier. They won't have sick people to take care of. Now, the insurance company industry came out and said, basically, you know, we think these refundable tax credits really aren't high enough because we recognize that for older people and sicker people, probably won't be enough to allow them to buy health insurance. But I think that they're sitting pretty right now, and they have the power, because if they decide in June, now, another thing I didn't tell you, and you may know this, all of these changes, if they come to be, it won't come out in this manner, it'll come out in some other fashion, it'll be different, but if the scaffold of this comes forward, it doesn't go into effect until 2020. So we have two more years to limp along. And it's in the best interest of every elected official in Washington to keep the insurance companies on the exchanges in the meantime. So in the short term, I think you're going to find they're going to try to prop up the insurance markets and the industries. Maybe they'll do another reinsurance mechanism. Maybe Congress will come up with monies that they took away because now it helps them. And, you know, we'll see. One way to look at it is it could get so bad that in 2020, you know, maybe Bernie Sanders comes back and we have single payer. I don't know.
Sorry, this is a question about sort of a theoretical question, and it's motivated a little bit by the question over there about just the cost of health care. I remember 5 or so years ago, I was spending a lot of time as a retired amateur looking into things about this. And I remember that, it was longer ago than that, because Obama's budget director, Peter Orszag, would go around and give seminars, and he would show data from Medicare expenditures. I think these were analyses from the Dartmouth Public Health School. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating. The Medicare data were presumed to be a good proxy for healthcare expenditures in general, mm-hmm. because it's a good data set and so forth. Mm-hmm. And if you corrected best effort for demographics, for different degrees of affluence, different geographical regions, whatever, you could see that Medicare expenditures per capita for the same outcomes varied by a factor of 2, depending on where you were in the country. And so his argument was that at least theoretically, if you could use evidence-based medicine, things, if you could disseminate all of these best practices and so forth, you could reduce health care costs by, you could make them 50% of what they are, just if you really pursued that to its logical extreme. Do you believe there's any essence there or not?
Great. You've just gone to graduate school in health policy. So that's the Dartmouth Atlas. It's John Weinberg and Elliot Fisher and those folks, and whom I admire tremendously. And basically, that's the geographic variation. And so a hip replacement in Minneapolis will cost 2/3 what it'll cost in Miami when you adjust for demographic factors. Why is that? Well, it's because of what we call supply-induced demand. So what do you have in Miami? You got a lot of old people. And when you got a lot of old people, you got a lot of doctors. And so what we know is when you have a lot of doctors in a certain geographic area, they tend, especially if they're specialists, they tend to practice more aggressively than if you have fewer doctors. That, in part, is to, and I'm not saying this, full disclosure, my father was a physician, my daughter's a physician. I love physicians. Physicians will often work to meet their target income. And because medicine is so, you know, there's so gray. I mean, do you need that extra test? Well, why don't we just do it just to, you know, peace of mind? You know, so there's always more to do in medicine. It's what Victor Fuchs, a health economist, calls a super good. The demand for it is almost insatiable. So all healthcare is local, and in those geographic areas where you have more doctors and potentially so more supply, you would literally induce the demand, and then depending on the market dynamics, the price will follow. Here's a really good example. Here we are in Charlottesville, and UVA, you know, if you want to get brain surgery, you probably want to go to UVA, even though you might say, I don't like those residents, I don't want a medical student traipsing in and out, and the parking, God knows, is horrible. So, you know, but I want the best brain surgeon, and they're probably going to be at an academic health center. And so when the Aetnas, when all the insurance companies of the world even Medicare Advantage and so on, say, you know, we really want UVA to be in our network. UVA says, UVA has leverage. UVA can kind of say, name their price. And in fact, how many of you have Medicare Advantage? Okay. Isn't it? You can tell me. I think last year was the first year. I think Humana is the only Medicare Advantage product in this market. And before last year, UVA was not in its network. Right. So UVA is in its network now. Why was UVA not in its network? Because UVA's prices are 130% of what Martha Jefferson's prices are. Okay? Drive 70 miles to Richmond. You've got Bon Secours, you've got MCV, you've got Hospital Corporation of America. You have a lot more competition on the hospital side. So when the insurers come into that market, they contract with hospitals, and the insurers have the leverage because they can choose among those facilities that can offer similar services. So that's another piece of the pie. It's what will the market bear, depending on who has leverage in the market. And sometimes it's the insurers, and sometimes it's the doctors. And when we induce demand, and Medicare doesn't, you know, Medicare pays pretty well. And I mean, by that I mean, it doesn't disallow much. And so it's easy to just keep running up the tab if you have specialists. The typical Medicare, traditional Medicare person sees nine physicians. So you can see how easy it is just to keep, you know, ching, ching, ching. It just adds up. What I would advocate, what you have alluded to, I think where healthcare needs to go, is we need to have insurance products that only pay for evidence-based medicine. So if we know that, you know, you don't get an MRI for a migraine unless you've tried this, this, and this, then that's what they'll pay for. If we can benchmark our reimbursement structure based on evidence-based medicine, then I think that in itself would begin to chip away at all the waste. The Dartmouth Atlas folks whom you referenced have shown that up to 30% of everything we do in our healthcare system is either inappropriate or unnecessary. And if you talk to residents that I teach, they will tell you, and medical students, every single day they see tons of waste in the inpatient setting. Now, we're a teaching hospital. It, by definition, is inefficient because we're teaching people to be doctors and they have to try things. But there's a lot. So when people bring up the R word, like, oh my gosh, we're going to have to start rationing care, I say, you know, let's try to be more efficient. If we could just do things that actually work and not just do things, then we could probably save money before we had to not give the 85, you know, Alzheimer's patients, deny them for whatever. So I don't even want to go there. But you know what I'm saying. So we can improve things a lot, but it takes political will to do that. Yes, sir.
You've begun to, just begun to answer my question, and it is to do with what impact in the next couple of years do you see this whatever is going on in Washington will have on Medicare specifically, mm-hmm. and Medicare Advantage, which you were just beginning to talk about, and the Medicare supplemental policies.
Right. So this is one group. I don't have to define Medicare, Medicare Advantage, and supplemental, Medigap, right? You guys know that. As you know, Paul Ryan has been an evangelist for moving Medicare from a defined benefit program to a defined contribution program. He calls it premium support. What does that mean? So let's say that I wish I could, I don't know all of these figures. Let's just say that the average Medicare recipient uses $10,000. I mean, let's just say it's a $10,000 a year per capita expenditure. So right now, Medicare has no budget. What what the federal government does at the end of the year, it's like an open checkbook. They just add it up at the end of the year and say, oh, guess what? This year we spent $500 billion in Medicare, and we spent 5% more than last year. So what a premium support would do, or a defined contribution would do, is that the federal government would give each Medicare beneficiary a voucher, say, let's say $10,000. And then you would take that voucher, and not unlike the ACA exchanges, and you would go to Humana. And we're at a disadvantage. We're in a small geographic area, so we don't have a lot of competition. But you would then take that to a private health insurance company, and they would say, great, love your $10,000, and oh yeah, you'd like vision and maybe dental too, and okay, you want me to wrap in the Part D for your prescription drugs? Okay. On top of that, why don't you pay $100 a month premium? Okay, everybody's happy. So you go merrily along, and then the next year, medical inflation is, well, this year it was 5.8%. Say it's 6%. But the economy only grows 2%. So your voucher only grows 2%. But it's not going to buy as much because healthcare spending has grown 6%. So over time, you can see the beauty of it from a budgeting perspective, because you can control it. You have a budget. You know, you have X many Medicare beneficiaries times $10,000 each. That's a budget. And so it makes it easier for the federal government to plan and know what their exposure is. But over time, that voucher will not keep up with the growth in medical spending. And the fear is that right now, something like two-thirds of people over the age of 65 and older than that, mostly, live only on their Social Security checks, which is about $1,200 a month. And if you're a couple, it's about $2,400 a month. So when you get to that point where your voucher isn't buying you as much as it did 5 years before, you may or may not have the discretionary income to fill that gap. And the fear is that Medicare would become, that the Medicare for some people would become more like Medicaid. Medicare Advantage is the fastest growing piece of Medicare. 30% of all Medicare beneficiaries now are on Medicare Advantage. Medicare Advantage, as you all may know, is signing on with a private health insurer who assumes the financial risk for you. The government pays them to take care of you, and it bundles Part A, which is hospital, your Part B contribution goes to it, and they bundle in Part D. So it's like going to the restaurant. Instead of paying a la carte, you have a prefix situation. And people like it. It's cheaper, tends to have more benefits. As I said before, maybe dental, maybe vision. People don't like it sometimes because, like other private health insurance, you have a preferred network of providers. If you have a Medicare Advantage plan, you probably can't go to the Mayo Clinic to get the second opinion. But it tends to be less expensive, and it does bundle everything, which is very attractive. What we know from the literature is that when Medicare recipients become very ill and run up large bills and have chronic illnesses, they often switch from Medicare Advantage back into traditional Medicare. Medigap, I think Medigap is on its last legs. Medigap is a supplemental insurance plan that fills in the gaps of deductibles and other copays for traditional Medicare. Many legislators, some health policy analysts think that Medigap is too generous and that it promotes overuse of services because of this moral hazard problem. You don't know how much anything really costs. You don't really care because you're not really paying for it because you have insurance, and so you use more of it. I think what and what policy experts suggest is that over time, the Medigap plans will become, you'll have a higher deductible. You'll have to pay more out of pocket for it. So I think that's what's going to happen in the future.
Carolyn, can you talk a little bit about the individual mandate, which you said is going to be eliminated and replaced with a continuous care agreement? And I wondered, for your 33-year-old contractor, if you also keep the ban on pre-existing conditions, why would she sign up for health care until she needed it?
Excellent point. So the individual mandate didn't really work very well under the ACA because the penalty wasn't very much. Last year, 6 million people paid a penalty for not being insured, and the average penalty was about $440. Now compare that to buying insurance if you didn't get a subsidy that cost $5,000. $440, $5,000, you know. So it was, so many people thought, you know, they need to make that, they need to make it the punishment harder. That, you know, really, in order to make the individual mandate work, you almost had to make the penalty the price of the cheapest insurance product. Well, that was then. Under this new regime, if it goes through, they say, we don't want no stinking individual mandate. Americans hate it. It's just anti-American. It's not in our collective DNA to be told what to do. So we're going to do this thing called continuous coverage. And that is, as long as you have continuous insurance coverage, you won't have to pay any more because of a pre-existing condition if you change health plans. So the way that, and this is kind of in the weeds, but if you have health insurance and you move, because we're not talking about employer-sponsored insurance now, we're talking about the individual market, and you move and you have to buy new insurance, you have 63 days to buy a new plan, and then you're golden. You no longer have to pay more. If you wait 65 days and you buy a new plan, that new plan can look at your medical history and can say, gee, I see you had an abnormal thyroid scan 2 years ago. We're going to offer you coverage, but we might carve out any thyroid-related problems for the first year, and you're going to have to pay 30% more. That's the continuous coverage penalty. So they can't turn them away, but they can charge them more and conceivably give them skimpier plans. The Republicans think that it makes sense that people would want to stay continuously covered and that that will be an incentive for people to keep their health insurance. But guess what? Most Americans don't act that way. For instance, people my age saving for retirement, of the baby boomers, only 1 in 5 actually is saving. And our 33-year-old contractor, you know, decides to move to Boulder because she's fallen in love and her partner is out there, and she goes out there and she's having kind of a hard time getting her job going again because she's an independent contractor. And before she knows it, it's been like 3 months and she hasn't gotten health insurance. And so she's going to have to pay this 30% more to get health insurance. Or she might say, you know, I'm really not very sick. Why don't I just go to a doc in the box? I'll just go to MedExpress or whatever. And then, you know, 6 months later, something happens and she needs health insurance. And so then she can sign up and she has to pay 30% more. But that may not be, when you need health insurance, all of a sudden, you know, what seemed expensive before doesn't seem so expensive. So I think you're exactly right. And a lot of experts are saying, you know, they don't think it's going to make people sign up more. It may be even, and if that's true, then there will be only more adverse selection in the insurance pool and only more reasons for the insurers to bail.
Hi.
Hi. Now I can see you.
This is my TA from my Ollie class. She was so fabulous.
That was a great class. You missed a good one. I am curious if we are ever going to find a balance between the free market and public health. And my concern is pharmaceuticals, like EpiPen going pshew. And sure, you go to the doctor and you get diagnosed, but then you've got to be on medicine. And there seems to be no interest in what is the public welfare, what does the public need, it's how much money can we make. So please address that.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, what I can tell you is, in public opinion surveys, the pharmaceutical industry now is hated more than the health insurance industry. And so, and I do think it's gotten Congress's attention, but, you know, this will they be able to negotiate? Will Medicare be able to negotiate? The only way we can address that, well, there are multiple ways, but eventually someone's going to have, there is no market. I mean, the drugs are priced with whatever the market will bear. I've been teaching medical students all week. I get the third year students when they came back from their years on the ward doing their clerkships, and then we have a 7-day health policy immersion every morning for 7 days, and I trot out my favorite faculty, young faculty mostly, and one of the GI docs came and he talked about, so normally, you know, I talk like, you know, we spend $3.2 trillion in our healthcare system, 2.5 times more per capita than any other developed country, and yada, yada, yada. You know, what does that mean? This year, I brought it down and said, what does it mean to patients? So I brought in a GI doc who treats only liver, and all, you know, a lot of his patients have hepatitis C. Do you know how much it costs to treat hepatitis C? $100,000. $100,000, but it is cost effective. Cost effective doesn't mean cheap. Cost effective means the value over time. The drugs for Hep C will cure hepatitis C. It will cure them. But there are 3 million Americans with hepatitis C. It will break the bank. We can't afford it. So that's just an example of exactly what you're talking about. In Switzerland, that exact same regimen is half of what it is here. Now, we can't send our patients to Switzerland. And so it's going to take some regulation. The market can't do this. There are not enough competitors. The patents, drugs are protected under patent for a fairly long period of time. But there are things you can do. Right now, you probably don't know. Some pharmaceutical companies actually pay generic companies not to put out generics. So you could come in that way. You can ask the FDA to fast track some drugs. Right now, the pharmaceutical industry, for every $1 they spend on marketing through direct consumer advertising, they recoup $4 in sales. We in New Zealand are the only countries that allow direct-to-consumer advertising. We could reduce that. We could provide incentives to pharmaceutical companies to invest in alternatives to expensive drugs. And that's what happened with the EpiPen. Now supposedly you can go to CVS and buy the same thing for like $20. So it takes regulation, unfortunately it takes something horrible happening usually to get government to wake up. The pharmaceutical industry lobbyists paid, we have 435 members of Congress, and the pharmaceutical industry invested, I don't know, like $5 per congressperson. I mean, millions and millions and millions of dollars. And so in the old days, we used to say you can't have health care reform until you have campaign finance reform. And we may be back there again, but That is who we are. You know, I tell my students, you know, we are not Canada because we are not Canada. You know, our motto is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's who we are. Individual responsibility, individual freedoms, civil liberties. That the analog to that in Canada, does anybody know what that is? The old guy with the t-shirt on? Go ahead. Peace, order, and good government. Canada is a country that has almost no defense. They have a socialized healthcare system. And I suppose they're orderly. But so that's who they are. We like choice. Even we conflate choice with quality all the time. But that's who we are. And so somehow we've got to reconcile how much we're spending, who is suffering, who the winners are, who the losers are, with our norms and our values as Americans. That's what has to go into our little cauldron. And I invite you to, I have 4 minutes. I'll just say this and then we'll ask, I'll let you have the last question. I invite you all to remain engaged. It's very, very important. This is the only way we can change things, is by keeping people's feet to the fire. And the way we can do that mostly is in the ballot box. Yes, ma'am.
Spoke about something happening to wake us up. If Agent Orange didn't wake us up, what did 7-Eleven do? That's all I ask.
9-11. Yeah.
No, I always get that wrong.
It's okay.
9-11.
We know what you meant. I think 9-11 did sort of wake us up, and a lot of the terrorist activities have, you know, We're living in dangerous and terrifying times, but we can come together as a country, and this is the only way we can change things. And so I believe that every time we talk to other people, we can impart knowledge, and if our citizens can become better educated citizens, and not listen to just sound bites and cable television, then, you know, we do have the potential to really move this country forward. And so I hope you'll continue to be concerned and active. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. That's been fantastic. Really appreciate it.